for our own stations, materially and spiritually, through that search. A devotion to progress in history began with Judeo-Christian religion as well. Most important, Judeo-Christian thought and Greek thought both held in common the belief in purpose. But, advocates of the revisionist Enlightenment history say, what if the Judeo-Christian belief system and the Greek devotion to reason were necessary to build Western civilization, but later prevented Western civilization from fully realizing its potential? What if the ideas of Judeo-Christianity and Greece weren't foundational? What if they were more like a scaffolding to be removed from the structure as Western thought solidified? What if we could pick and choose our favorite ideas from the Enlightenment canon and junk all the rest? As we'll see, we tried it. It failed. In reality, just as with every other philosophical development in history, the Enlightenment had its upside, the glories of American founding philosophy and Western classical liberalism, both of which were direct outgrowths of Athens and Jerusalem, and it had its downside. What was that downside? The downside began with the purposeful destruction of Judeo-Christian values and Greek teleology. It turns out that those thinkers who maintained the wisdom of those twin foundations built the power and glory of the modern West. Those who sought to chip away at those foundations would eventually emerge victorious, and their victory would plant the seeds for an existential crisis of meaning from which the West suffers more deeply every day. And even their supposed devotion to reason itself would be consumed by the reflexive instinct to tear down the old, no matter how objectively good it was. From Virtue to Moral Relativism. The original drive to discard God in Western thought grew from three intertwined forces. First, the drive against religion sprang from the dissolution of Catholic dominance. That dissolution created religious schisms and vacuums that all too often invited brutal violence. Critics of Judeo-Christian faith saw in the internecine religious warfare proof that religious fundamentalism inhibited human freedom rather than deepening it. Second, atheism and agnosticism saw a dramatic upswing among intellectuals thanks to the rise in religious fundamentalism. Both Lutheranism and Calvinism were, at least in part, responses to the perceived secularization of the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church moved to mitigate such religious insurgencies by cracking down on its own tendencies towards secular learning. Religion did become more of an obstacle to secular learning as Catholic homogeneity receded. Finally, the fragmentation of control by the Catholic Church led to more room to breathe for dissenters. The Peace of Westphalia was explicitly designed to promote more religious freedom for minority religions, and that also allowed new, agnostic philosophies to flourish. The earliest signs of a philosophical movement breaking with Judeo-Christian morality and Aristotelian virtue came from Machiavelli. An active and rigorous debate rages on about whether Machiavelli was a religious man or a covert atheist, but suffice it to say that his reverence for the Bible was questionable. In The Prince, he cites Moses as an example of a war leader, while jokingly calling him a mere executor of the will of God, and brazenly explaining, it was necessary, therefore, to Moses that he should find the people of Israel in Egypt enslaved and oppressed by the Egyptians, in order that they should be disposed to follow him so as to be delivered out of bondage. As to Greek allegiance to virtue, Machiavelli, in typical mocking fashion, hijacks the term itself. No longer should men be governed by virtue, he states. Now, they should be governed by virtu, a combination of evil and good designed to achieve a certain end and overcome the chaos of fortune, fortuna. As Harvey Mansfield writes, Machiavelli wants to give Renaissance humanism a hard face, to deflate its esteem for classical rhetoric, to attack its adherence to philosophical tradition, to unsettle its accommodation with Christianity, to refute its belief in the virtues of the classical gentleman, and to remind it of the value and glory of the military. Machiavelli's early iteration of a break from traditional purpose found its first open embrace in Hobbes. Hobbes applied the standards of rigorous logic to religious revelation itself, and found revelation wanting. To say God hath spoken to him in a dream is no more than to say that he dreamed God spake to him, which is not of force to win belief from any man that knows dreams are for the most part natural and may proceed from former thought, Hobbes wrote. If one prophet deceive another, what certainty is there of knowing the will of God by other way than that of reason? Hobbes doesn't merely dismiss the Judeo-Christian moral system as divine. He also discards the Aristotelian telos. There is no such finish ultimus, utmost aim, nor summum bonum, greatest good, as is spoken of in the books of the old moral philosophers. Felicity is a continual progress of the desire from one object to another, the attaining of the former being still but the way to the latter. In other words, the search for meaning cannot be found in seeking final causes. Nature contains no such information. Instead, morality must be boiled down to mere competition of interests and the desire of human beings to avoid suffering and untimely death. In a state of nature, nothing can be unjust. The notions of right and wrong, justice and injustice have there no place. Where there is no common power, there is no law. Where no law, no injustice. If moral relativism began anywhere, it began in Hobbes. Hobbes's skepticism of Judeo-Christian morality and Aristotelian teleology found alliance in a most unlikely philosopher, a brilliant lapsed Jew named Baruch Spinoza, 1632 to 1677. Spinoza grew up an Orthodox Jew in the Netherlands, but was excommunicated for heresy in 1656. His crime involved his declarations that the Bible did not mention immortality, that God might take physical form in the universe, and that the immortal soul might not actually be immortal, but mere life force. He proceeded to write some of the most well-read philosophical treatises in history, and his anti-religious thought took center stage. Where Hobbes was playfully vague as to his views of the Bible, Spinoza took no prisoners. He blasted religious authorities for being close-minded. He encouraged the faithful to seek the message of the Bible only in their own hearts and rip the textualism of biblical fundamentalists. Instead of God's word, they are beginning to worship likeness and images, that is, paper and ink. He declared that Moses did not write the Torah. He stated that the Torah had been written centuries later by another figure. He dismissed miracles, the text of the Bible, and its commandments. As proof of the Bible's non-divinity, Spinoza wrote in terms that would make Richard Dawkins proud. Religion is manifested not in charity, but in spreading contention among men and in fostering the bitterest hatred under the false guise of zeal in God's cause and a burning enthusiasm. Spinoza believed that the Bible had been written for the foolish and carried forward by them, but he was also politically astute enough not to disparage the New Testament as he did the Old Testament. Spinoza was similarly dismissive of the notion of a natural law. He turned his intense intellect to the very notion of final causes and dismissed them with relish. Humans, Spinoza argued, designed a God who had made the universe especially for mankind and reasoned in circular fashion that God had crafted a human purpose. Like Hobbes, this leads Spinoza to disparage the very notion of good or bad. And, like Hobbes, this led Spinoza to a sort of rational egotism as the nature of man. Human beings want to avoid pain and seek pleasure. The best way to do this, according to Spinoza, is through a stoic passivity, seeking knowledge of the universe and acknowledging that we are not at the center of it. While Hobbes's new morality led him to the foot of an all-encompassing state, Spinoza recommended the opposite, a minimal state designed merely to prevent insurrection from those whose rights are violated. Freedom of religion and speech, in this view, aren't rights so much as spheres of privacy the state ought to avoid if it knows what's good for it. This is a libertarianism based on practicality, not on principle per se. We don't know what is right or good or virtuous, and therefore the decent man will not foist his opinion on others. But in order for that sort of freedom to prevail, the state must agree not to become the tool of the powerful to quash disagreement. The final step away from Judeo-Christian ethical monotheism and Greek teleology and toward outright atheism came courtesy of jolly British empiricist David Hume, 1711 to 1776. Like Hobbes and Spinoza before him, Hume discounted the possibility of miracles. He said that the laws of nature speak to us more frequently than any human testimony, and therefore the evidence for miracles was annihilated. He even argued that polytheism was as rational as monotheism. He also attempted to demolish classical proofs of God's existence. He took on the cosmological argument by stating that it is quite possible for something to come from nothing, so the notion of an unmoved mover was unnecessary. He also attacked the idea that order requires design. He says that an acorn can grow an oak tree without design, for example. Most of all, Hume rejected the idea of a just God because of the presence of evil in the universe. Like Hobbes and Spinoza, Hume totally dismissed the notion that human beings could discern purpose or virtue from the bare facts of the material world. Hume famously summed up this problem in his is-ought distinction. Just because the natural world is a certain way doesn't mean we ought to do a certain thing. Discoverable purpose disappeared in Hume's philosophy. building on reason alone. Hume's atheism remained a minority position in his time. Most philosophers still believed in at least a deist conception of the universe, though they increasingly rejected the tenets of Judaism and Christianity. Most philosophers were also unwilling to concede to Hobbesian positivism, the idea that good and bad are human constructions dependent on power relationships. Instead, philosophers increasingly focused on rebuilding universal morality in the absence of the Bible. Having dethroned God as an active moral arbiter for human behavior and instead redefined God as the Aristotelian unmoved mover alone, man was free to search for a moral system using reason alone. But these same philosophers could no longer rely on Aristotelian teleology. They could not look at the nature of the universe and determine moral ends. New moral systems, therefore, had to be constructed from scratch. Human beings, these Enlightenment thinkers proposed, could construct systems to maximize human happiness. Now, in reality, most Enlightenment thinkers still operated off the moral assumptions of Judeo-Christian values, as well as Aristotelian teleology. Their intellectual engines were running on the fumes from a gas tank they had already purposefully emptied. It was only a matter of time until those fumes ran out. But the remnant vapors were responsible for some of humanity's most fascinating and complex attempts at creating a God-free, objective morality. Leading the way was Voltaire, 1694 to 1778. Voltaire was a deist. He famously stated, "It is perfectly evident to my mind that there exists a necessary, eternal, supreme, and intelligent being. This is no matter of faith, but of reason." Voltaire believed in the search for morality in reason. In his Philosophical Dictionary, he stated, "We cannot repeat too frequently that dogmas differ, but that morality is the same among all men who make use of their reason. Morality proceeds from God like light. Our superstitions are only darkness." But Voltaire plainly considered Judeo-Christian traditions superstitious. His writings are filled with nasty asides referring to Jews in particular. Like an 18th century Bill Maher, Voltaire delighted in ridiculing the most facially ridiculous statements of the Bible and declaring the Bible's morality abhorrent on his face. How then could morality be constructed through reason? It couldn't be done through Aristotelian teleology. Voltaire famously mocked the idea of a discoverable telos in nature, mocking the brilliant philosopher Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, 1646 to 1716, on those grounds. Leibniz argued that since God was good, and since God had created but one world, the world he had created was, by necessity, the best possible world. Voltaire mercilessly skewered that perspective in Candide. Pangloss taught metaphysico-theologico-cosmonigology. He could prove to wonderful effect that there was no effect without cause. "It is demonstrable," he would say, "that things cannot be other than as they are, for, since everything is made to serve an end, everything is necessarily for the best of ends. Observe how noses were formed to support spectacles, therefore we have spectacles. Legs are clearly devised for the wearing of breeches, therefore we wear breeches." Those who have argued that all is well have been talking nonsense. They should have said that all is for the best. Pangloss ends up contracting syphilis, loses an eye and an ear, and is hanged. So much for the best of all possible worlds, according to Voltaire. And so much for the notion that we can look at the nature of things and discover morality there. Voltaire scoffs at the idea of the Aristotelian good. Noses obviously weren't made for glasses. So where did Voltaire find purpose and morality? Like Francis Bacon, one of his intellectual heroes, he found it in the betterment of the human condition materially. And this led him toward a hedonistic, materialist morality as well. For those capable of exercising reason properly, the maximization of pleasure and minimization of pain was the paramount goal of life. His poetry is filled with unambiguous condemnation of religious prudery and embrace of the pleasures of the world. "Enjoying pleasure in each state and hour, mortals acknowledge God's eternal power. The modern Stoic would each wish control, and of its very essence rob my soul." Voltaire's morality tends toward the fully libertarian then, freedom from control, liberty in behavior. But such a system, absent the virtue of a citizenry, quickly collapses. Voltaire knew that, which is why he wished that those of lesser rational capacity worship an omnipotent, omniscient God. God was necessary for others, but not for Voltaire. Unfortunately, he would be proven right in his estimation of human nature in short order. By removing the supposed shackles of virtue, Voltaire also removed the constraints preventing chaos and tyranny. When Voltaire's version of freedom was mixed with the passion of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, 1712 to 1778, the result was the guillotine. Juxtaposed to the vainglorious, acidic Voltaire, Immanuel Kant, 1724 to 1804, appears a secular saint. Kant never left Königsberg, Prussia. He was certainly no hedonist. But, like Voltaire and Locke, Kant was a devotee of reason above all, even if he explored its limits to the utmost. In his essay, What is Enlightenment?, Kant spelled out the central philosophy of the era, Dare to know, sapere aude. Have the courage to use your own understanding is therefore the motto of the Enlightenment. And what of morality? Kant thought that the search for virtue could be found not through reason applied to the universe, but through investigation of the moral instinct. We all have an instinct for morality, Kant believed. Reason was limited, as human perception was limited. Kant remained skeptical of the human capacity to know the world. By looking at our moral instinct, Kant believed we could derive a universal morality. Two things fill the mind with ever new and increasing admiration and awe, the more often and steadily we reflect upon them. The starry heavens above me, and the moral law within me. Kant sought to locate the new meaning and purpose in a priori knowledge, things we can know without experiment or experience. Kant believed that certain truths were not dependent on the human experience. 2 plus 2 would always equal 4, whether or not human beings experienced it. Kant thus embarked on an almost Platonic quest for knowledge beyond the material, but where Plato looked to the realm of forms, Kant looked instead to the human heart. The human heart, he said, had embedded within it a moral logic, and that moral logic relied on categorical imperatives, absolute truths. These categorical imperatives included injunctions never to use other human beings as means, but rather to treat them as ends. Actions are good in and of themselves, not because they have good effects. And acting in pursuit of the good makes us free. The measure of religion itself is its adherence to this moral law of the heart. In short, act only according to that maxim whereby you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. To our secular minds, this is beautiful stuff, and the closest thing philosophy has ever crafted to a serious sense of meaning and purpose. But Kant's idealism could not sustain itself. His philosophy of morality soon fell apart. Kant's categorical imperative, the idea that every law must be generalizable, provides a nice guidepost for human activity, and one that seems to mirror the golden rule. But Kant's categorical imperative does not answer more complex moral calculations. Is it really correct that we do a wrong whenever we lie, even to hide a Jew when the Nazi is at the door, for example, as Kant seems to suggest? Furthermore, Kant's categorical imperative isn't objectively mandatory. Why not simply assume that everyone else should abide by Kant's rule and break all the rules yourself? And even if you don't wish your own self-serving priorities to rule, there are other moralities just as logical as Kant's. Indeed, Kant's categorical imperative was but one system for organizing human morality along the lines of a priori reason. Jeremy Bentham, 1748 to 1832, similarly sought to construct a moral system by using reason. And his system, unlike Kant's, wasn't based on universal moral principles, but on utility. Bentham believed that human action should be constructed to promote or oppose happiness, which could be measured in terms of pleasure and pain. Bentham believed, along the lines of Hobbes, that no rights preexisted the state and called natural rights nonsense upon stilts. Voltaire, Kant, Bentham all assumed that reason could construct morality from scratch. But their moralities did not coincide. Practically speaking, their morality lifted elements, even if unconsciously, from the Judeo-Christian tradition and Greek telos they suggested they had exploded. All of this left an unanswered question. If reason could not construct objective systems of morality, what could? What if faith in reason was misplaced and something darker actually motivated human beings? The death of capacity. The death of Judeo-Christian values and Greek telos didn't mean the liberation of reason from superstition. For some key philosophers, it meant the destruction of reason itself. That may seem counterintuitive. After all, philosophers had tossed out the Bible and Aristotle in the name of reason. But the Enlightenment did not merely involve utilizing reason to question Judeo-Christian values and telos. It involved turning reason in on itself, examining the human mind. It meant obliterating mankind as the jewel of the cosmos, bringing him low, returning him to the animals, rather than allowing him to aspire to join the divine. By throwing God out of the kingdom of man, the Enlightenment also reduced man to a creature of flesh and blood, with no transcendent reason to guide the way. Machiavelli and Bacon had both recognized the power of passion, but they had also upheld the rule of reason above passion. Machiavelli believed that passion could be manipulated to useful effect by reason-driven leaders, and that passion could be used to check passion. Bacon believed that reason could be successfully applied to the universe to unlock its secrets for the betterment of mankind. Neither Machiavelli nor Bacon significantly undermined the belief in the free will of humans. Machiavelli's devotion to virtu sprang from his desire to oppose fortuna, the vagaries of fortune, which could thwart even the best laid plans. Machiavelli sought to overcome fortune with will, with the concerted use of means to achieve goals. Not so with Hobbes. Hobbes, who was deeply devoted to tearing down Greek teleology, attacked not only the idea that the universe had discoverable purpose, but that human beings were capable of exercising reason more broadly. "The passions of men," Hobbes writes, "are commonly more potent than their reason. Reason cannot bring happiness, nor can it be used as the goal of a philosophical life. There is no happiness. There is only striving and security and passion. Reason cannot save us from the war of all against all. Only the Leviathan, the power of the state, can." Hobbes's skepticism of reason was mirrored by Descartes, who suggested that human beings were driven by passion rather than reason. But Spinoza made the most radical break with the past when he discarded the notion of free will altogether. He likened human beings to stones cast through space, but believing that they move themselves. Such a stone, being conscious merely of its own endeavor and not at all indifferent, would believe itself to be completely free, and would think that it continued in motion solely because of its own wish. That is that human freedom, which all boast that they possess, and which consists solely in the fact that men are conscious of their own desire, but are ignorant of the causes whereby that desire has been determined. Through reason, human beings are capable of better understanding their plight, and this grants them some limited measure of freedom, but their freedom of action is heavily circumscribed. It was left to Hume, once again, to completely circumscribe reason. "Reason is, and ought only to be, the slave of the passions," Hume famously wrote, taking to its logical extreme the thought of his predecessors. "Reason cannot be the source of moral good or evil, which are found to have that influence." Hume's contemporary and friend Jean-Jacques Rousseau accepted Hume's essential argument about human nature, but then elevated the passions in a way Hume never did. "No," said Rousseau, "passions were good. Man was perfectible, and morality was based on empathy." In the beginning, Rousseau argued, man lived in harmony with nature, comfortable and indolent, until he formed societal bonds. Those societal bonds were formed in an attempt to perfect human nature, to develop human nature itself. Human beings gathered together and lived as communities in the happiest and most stable of epochs before greed came to the fore, pushing men to create surplus rather than surviving at subsistence levels. Property was the death of the natural man. The first man who, having enclosed a piece of ground, bethought himself of saying, "This is mine," and found people simple enough to believe him, was the real founder of civil society, Rousseau wrote. But now that society had been created, human beings could only find happiness through an administration of the general will. As Marianne Glendon writes, "an agreement by which everyone would give himself and all his goods to the community, forming a state whose legislation would be produced by the will of each person thinking in terms of all. And that state would be led by a transformative leader dedicated to changing human nature." This move away from reason and toward passion, the rejection of Judeo-Christian values and Greek teleology, may have been popular among philosophers, but it remained a rather fringy perspective. All that changed, however, with the rise of Darwinism. Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species, 1859, provided the first scientific grounding to the notion of a world without God and a world beyond the mind of man. With Darwin's evolutionary biology, a unifying field theory of life could suddenly be proposed. Accident. God did not create man in his image. Man was merely the next step in a chain of evolution propelled forward by natural selection. There was no telos to the universe. There was merely nature, and man was part of it. Man was an animal. God was unnecessary. Reason itself disappeared into higher brain function designed for better environmental adaptation. Objective truth itself became an article of faith, since the human mind was designed not for its discovery, but for finding the nuts and berries necessary to ward off death and pain. Morality, too, was an outgrowth of simple convention and adaptive innovation. Animals could engage in rudimentary moral behavior without any semblance of human reason. Darwinism was seen by the intelligentsia of the time as a final permission to break with the ways of the ancients. Finally, at long last, the superstitions of religion could be put aside. Finally, at long last, the legacy of the ancient Greeks could be escaped. Mankind, in joining the animals, had finally liberated himself from the chains of the divine. In fact, the excitement of Darwinism can still be felt today in the literature of atheists like Daniel Dennett, who writes, "Darwin's idea is a universal solvent capable of cutting right to the heart of everything in sight. The question is, what does it leave behind?" Dennett claims that we are left with stronger, sounder versions of our most important ideas. But were we? As the scientific world celebrated its newfound elevation over Judeo-Christian values and Greek telos, two figures emerged to warn the West of what was to come. One was a Russian novelist, the other a German philosopher. The Warning. Fyodor Dostoevsky, 1821 to 1881, worried deeply about mankind unbound from moral obligation. He saw in the rise of an atheistic world the face of the Marquis de Sade, 1740 to 1814, the famed French sadist, rapist, and pedophile who embraced passion, discounted human responsibility, and saw in his own pleasure the highest good. De Sade infamously dismissed God and added, "We rail against the passions, but never think that it is from their flame that philosophy lights its torch." Dostoevsky saw the Sadean perspective as the logical endpoint of a system without God, theorizing that without immortality, all constraints on human behavior would disappear. He foresaw that materialist man was far more of a threat than religious man, that human beings who think themselves mere agglomerations of matter without the responsibility of choice will throw decency aside. He saw that man would find in his search for purpose something far darker than the Judeo-Christian tradition and Greek teleology that built the modern world. Dostoevsky feared the materialism that had come to dominate European thought. In the famous Grand Inquisitor chapter of The Brothers Karamazov, in which Ivan Karamazov tells his tale of a Spanish inquisitor grilling Jesus, Dostoevsky suggested that the day had come when human beings would give up on meaning in favor of worldly goods. "Dost thou know that the ages will pass, and humanity will proclaim by the lips of their sages that there is no crime and therefore no sin? There is only hunger?" Dostoevsky suggested the cure for hunger would be the dictator. The man who satiates hunger will be worshipped as a deity. Human beings, Dostoevsky suspected, were too frightened to use God-given freedom of will to seek God himself. Instead, they would retreat into infantilism, happy to follow leaders who will relieve them of their need for bread and provide them the comfort of conformity, promising them that their sins mean nothing. "We shall show them that they are weak, that they are only pitiful children, but that childlike happiness is the sweetest of all." The dark side of the Enlightenment was no secret to Dostoevsky, who saw the rumblings of a coming cataclysm looming through the mists of the future. He knew that reason alone, unmoored from God, could not hold back the tide. In fact, reason itself would provide the impetus for evil, he argued. In Notes from the Underground, Dostoevsky decried the scientific optimism of the materialists, scoffing at their suggestion that human weakness would be eradicated by common sense and science, completely re-educating human nature. He laughed at the notion that men could be told that they lacked the ability to choose, but could simply be guided toward morality by the application of scientific rules. No, Dostoevsky stated, man would rebel against such logic. Human beings were not made for it. What man wants is simply independent choice, whatever that independence may cost and wherever it may lead. And choice, of course, the devil only knows what choice. Human beings are creatures who seek more than that which reason and science purport to give them, and they are more than the self-interested animals reason and science seek to make them. The search for meaning, untrammeled by Judeo-Christian values and Greek telos, freed from moral responsibility by scientific determinism, would burst forth in a conflagration that will set the whole world on fire, Dostoevsky predicted. The result would be blood and suffering, a maelstrom of horror, followed by an epic of emptiness. God's death, Dostoevsky thought, was man's death as well. The Triumph of the Will. The death of God, Friedrich Nietzsche, 1844 to 1900, saw, left no room for purpose through reason. Like Hume, Nietzsche believed that morality through reason alone was a lie, a cover for instinct wearing the costume of reason. Your decision, this is right, has a previous history in your impulses, your likes and dislikes. Nietzsche, in other words, had consolidated the lessons of the 18th and 19th centuries and ripped the mask of nicety from the face of the Enlightenment. Reason and passion are both aspects of something deeper, something primordial, Nietzsche stated, the will to power. Nietzsche suggested that we stop brooding over the moral worth of our actions. Instead, he said, let us seek to become what we are, the new, the unique, the incomparable, making laws for ourselves, and creating ourselves. Nietzsche knew that the only answer to scientific materialism was radical subjectivity, and with it would come the death of morals. He celebrated that fact and reveled in the power of the will. What exactly is the will to power? It is the will to self-perfection. In Thus Spake Zarathustra, Nietzsche poeticizes, "Before God, now however this God hath died, ye higher men, this God was your greatest danger. Now only travaileth the mountain of the human future. God hath died, now do we desire the Superman to live. The most careful ask today, how is man to be maintained? Zarathustra, however, asketh, as the first and only one, how is man to be surpassed? The Superman I have at heart. That is the first and only thing to me, and not man, not the neighbor, not the poorest, not the sorriest, not the best." Nietzsche advocated the destruction of Judeo-Christian values. He properly understood that all other systems of morality, from utilitarianism to Kantian categorical imperatives, are based at root on the moral discoveries of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And he said that man can only be freed by destroying that moral vestigial structure. That structure, he believed, had held man back. It was slave morality, which sacrificed strength for weakness, which celebrated poverty and powerlessness. What was required is a new morality. Man could create his own morality, but only on the basis of strength and will. That morality will no longer be based on human happiness. It would not be based on how to maintain himself best, longest, most pleasantly. These were petty virtues, Nietzsche claimed. Instead, Nietzsche valued honesty and struggle, strength and courage. He valued man unbound. What Nietzsche observed and what he lauded had been underway for generations. Philosophy spent 2 centuries killing Judeo-Christian values and Greek teleology, or at least discarding them in favor of brave new utopias filled with perfectible human beings, or crystal palaces ruled by men of reason, or worlds of determinism filled with avoidance of pain and maximization of pleasure. Either man would rule supreme, or he would destroy all in his path. Which would it be? The world would soon find out the answer to that question. Chapter 7. The Remaking of the World. Why can't we all just be reasonable? This is the characteristic call of our age. Forget values. Forget judgment. Let's just be reasonable with each other. Tolerance can supplant Judeo-Christian ideas. We all know what's right deep down. If we follow our star, civilization won't just survive, it will thrive and flourish. This idea is a vestige of the Enlightenment mentality, but it ignores the dark side of the Enlightenment hope. It ignores the history of the 19th and 20th centuries. It ignores the fact that the Enlightenment had 2 strains, one based on Athens and Jerusalem, the other bereft of them. History performed a comparative study in which form of Enlightenment worked best, and the results were clear and convincing. The Enlightenment straddled 2 sides of a thin line. On the one side was the American Enlightenment, based on the consummation of a long history of thought stretching back to Athens and Jerusalem, down through Great Britain and the Glorious Revolution, and to the New World. On the other was the European Enlightenment, which rejected Athens and Jerusalem in order to build new worlds beyond discoverable purpose and divine revelation. The juxtaposition between the American Revolution and the French Revolution demonstrates the contrast between the strains of Enlightenment thinking. The American Revolution, based on Lockean principles regarding the God-given rights of individuals, the value of social virtue, and a state system created to preserve inalienable individual rights, broke sharply with the French Revolution, based on Rousseau's general will, Voltaire's generalized scorn for traditional virtue, and an optimistic sense of the perfectibility of mankind through the application of virtue-free reason. The French Revolution was born with a utopian sense of purpose. Man would finally be freed of old constraints. Those constraints were not merely political. They were constraints of the soul, chains on human freedom itself. The most obvious chains were those imposed by religion itself, which the French philosophers saw not as the bulwark for Western morality and rationality, but as the chief obstacle to them. It was Denis Diderot, the editor of the famed Encyclopedia, who said he wished to strangle the last king with the guts of the last priest. Once the last priest was dead, then presumably mankind could reach back toward the nature within and find within himself the capacity for godlike power and wisdom. Nicolas de Condorcet, the French philosopher and early revolutionary, stated that science would rescue man from his flaws, foresee the progress of humankind, direct it, and accelerate it. Reason without boundaries, combined with natural passion, would soon make for a toxic admixture. While the United States moved toward the embrace of an enlightenment based on Locke, Blackstone, Montesquieu, and the Bible, the first meeting of the United States Senate occurred on March 4, 1789, the French Revolution moved toward utopian rebuilding. On July 14, 1789, French citizens stormed the Bastille, and they quickly dethroned the kings and the priests. The cult of reason became the first official religion of the New France. It worshipped one God only, the pupil, according to the revolutionary Anacharsis Clootz. God himself was stripped of his holiness, and reason accorded his place. Frenchmen were to celebrate the Festival of Reason. That festival saw churches across France transformed into temples of reason, with the chief temple being the cathedral at Notre Dame. There, the musicians of the National Guard and opera performed hymns to liberty, serving liberty as a deity. The opening anthem was, "Descend, O Liberty, Daughter of Nature." An inscription, "To Philosophy," was placed at the entrance, and the flame of the goddess of reason was lit on the Greek altar. Maximilian Robespierre, who disdained the excesses of festivals of the cult of reason, founded a more sober-minded cult of the supreme being, but it was similarly atheistic and worshipped similar principles. Festivals were so well staged that Jacques-Louis David, the revolutionary artist, scripted, "The moment when mothers must smile at their children, the old men at the youths and their grandsons." In March 1794, Robespierre had the leaders of the cult of reason executed. In July 1794, Robespierre himself was executed. When Napoleon took power, he reacted to the cult by banning them outright. The end of the rejection of Judeo-Christian churches in favor of secular churches was the guillotine. The French Revolution also replaced the virtue of the ancients, seeking an objective code for living by investigating the universe using our right reason, with the virtue of the collective, or with radical subjectivism, or both. Robespierre defined virtue in a speech extolling the new French Republic. It is nothing else than the love of the patrie and its laws. To defend that virtue required everything up to and including political violence. If the driving force of popular government in peacetime is virtue, that of popular government during a revolution is both virtue and terror. Virtue without which terror is destructive. Terror without which virtue is impotent. Diderot, a materialist who disdained even deism, defined virtue in pure terms of moral relativism. There is only one virtue, justice, one duty, to be happy, one corollary, not to overrate life and not to fear death. French historian Robert Mousy writes that Diderot believed that to be happy is to be oneself, that is, to preserve the truth which is peculiar to our being and which may choose to express itself through a passion incompatible with virtue. The rejection of Judeo-Christian values and ancient virtue on behalf of the general will was expressed in glowing terms in the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, approved by the National Assembly on August 26, 1789. Unlike the Declaration of Independence, a document expressing a collective desire for individual rights, the Declaration of the Rights of Man expresses the belief that man's place in the universe revolves around his role as part of a larger collective. Every individual right expressed in the French Declaration is curbed by the collective's right to overrule that individual. So, for example, the French Declaration states, "Men are born and remain free and equal in rights. Social distinctions may be founded only upon the general good." But the second clause renders the first absolutely meaningless. If men are equal in right, how can their rights be subject to the opinions of a majority? The answer is obvious. Rights in the French Declaration do not spring from God or pre-exist government. The principle of all sovereignty resides essentially in the nation. No body nor individual may exercise any authority which does not proceed directly from the nation. All rights come from the state. All rights, therefore, belong to the state. This is the Hobbesian Leviathan come to life. While the French Declaration pays homage to the non-aggression principle, it explicitly states that liberty consists in the freedom to do everything which injures no one else. These limits can only be determined by law. Such niceties disappear as soon as the document states that law is the expression of the general will. Religious rights are secondary to the public order established by law. Freedom of expression is guaranteed, except as shall be defined by law. The collective rules the individual, and the general will trumps the individual will. The leading philosophical twin lights of the Revolution were Voltaire and Rousseau, although both writers, particularly Voltaire, might well have disdained their legacy. Fully 13 years after Voltaire's death, the famed artist Jacques-Louis David organized a procession 100,000 strong to usher Voltaire's disinterred body to the Pantheon, the rechristened church of Sainte-Geneviève, secularized by the revolution. As historian Raymond Jonas writes, Voltaire's procession neatly aped the Catholic rituals associated with Corpus Christi. The stops at the Bastille and the Louvre resemble the processional pauses at Reposoir, and even recall Genevieve's triumphant procession resulting in the cure of the maladie d'Ardens. Rousseau was a key influence on Robespierre particularly. Robespierre wrote of him, "Divine man, you have taught me to know myself." It wasn't until after Robespierre's execution that Rousseau received the same treatment as Voltaire, but it was glorious indeed. His body was exhumed and then moved from Ermenonville to Paris, his coffin put in public view in the Tuileries, and then placed in the Pantheon near Voltaire. A statue of Rousseau came along for the ride, and a copy of The Social Contract was gently cradled on a velvet cushion. All across Paris, his plays were revived, and all across France, similar processions took place. The French Revolution was bloody, vicious, and awful. Tens of thousands of people were murdered by the regime between 1793 and 1794, with another 250,000 dead in a civil war over a draft designed to fight foreign invasion. And what followed the French Revolution, the rise of Napoleon Bonaparte, would cast the continent into a new era of upheaval. Where exactly did the French Revolution, born with dreams of liberty, equality, and fraternity, go so wrong? It went wrong because the Enlightenment of the French Revolution rejected the lessons of the past. It saw in the history of the West mere repression and brutality, and longed for a tomorrow full of visions and dreams based on vague notions of human goodness. The man who best critiqued the French Revolution lived just across the English Channel. His name was Edmund Burke, 1729 to 1797, and he was a member of Parliament sympathetic to the American colonists, but utterly opposed to the French Revolution. Burke argued that the French Revolution had failed because it had ignored the lessons of human nature, the morality of Christianity, and the traditions of the past. Written at the outset of the Revolution in 1789, Reflections on the Revolution in France became a seminal text for modern-day conservatives who saw in it a call from radicalism and towards sensible governance. The effect of liberty to individuals is that they may do what they please. We ought to see what it will please them to do before we risk congratulations, which may be soon turned into complaints, Burke wrote. He feared that the revolution had done away with the two foundations of Western civilization, the spirit of a gentleman and the spirit of religion. He warned that the triumph of supposed rationality over tradition and Judeo-Christian values would turn reason into a mere byword to be vulgarized by political forces. Their liberty is not liberal. Their science is presumptuous ignorance. Their humanity is savage and brutal. And he warned as well that such brutality would extend to seizure of property and life itself. How did Burke foresee the tragedy? Because he held true to the ancient precepts of Western civilization, Greek telos, and Judeo-Christian morality. Philosopher Russell Kirk writes of Burke's worldview, "Revelation, reason, and an assurance beyond the senses tell us that the author of our being exists and that he is omniscient, and man and the state are creations of God's beneficence. How are we to know God's mind and will? Through the prejudices and traditions which millennia of human experience with divine means and judgments have implanted in the mind of the species. And what is our purpose in the world? Not to indulge our appetites, but to render obedience to divine ordinance." Burke was correct, but the French Revolution had already initiated a cycle of reaction that would continue for the next 156 years. Its slogan, "Liberty, Equality, Fraternity," had already proved chimerical a mere 5 years after Burke's opus. Yet that creed would provide the impetus for a century and a half of political utopianism and its disastrous aftermath. Liberty would collapse into moral relativism and then tyranny. Fraternity would collapse into nationalistic tribalism. Equality would collapse into a new caste system, with all wise rulers in control of the commanding heights. The Utopia of Nationalism. Revolutionary France, which forcibly conscripted its own citizenry and turned itself into the first modern militarized state, celebrated the nation-state as the apotheosis of the general will. In doing so, the French were merely carrying forward the legacy of Rousseau. It was the French Revolution that made romantic nationalism a driving force in history. The very definition of citizenship changed in revolutionary France, from subjects at the beck and call of more powerful actors to citizens with an equal stake in the formation of the general will. But that definition of citizenship quickly devolved into a new form of subject status. In France, citizens owed their rights to the state. As Professor William Rogers Brubaker of Harvard University writes, "The revolution, in short, invented not only the nation-state, but the modern institution and ideology of national citizenship. Karl Marx, 1818 to 1883, suggested the gigantic broom of the French Revolution swept away all these relics, thus clearly simultaneously the social soil of its last hindrances to the superstructure of the modern state edifice. By centralizing power, the revolution discarded all boundaries between man and the state and made individuals feel part of a greater whole. The new state of France revolutionized war making. In 1793, as a result of both civil unrest and the decision to make war on Austria, the National Convention instituted the first mass draft in the history of the world. Where joining the military had been a preserve of a certain few, and high-ranking officers had been culled from aristocratic families, the French now substituted mass war making and a certain level of meritocracy. The Levée en Masse of August 23, 1793 stated, "From this moment until such time as its enemies shall have been driven from the soil of the Republic, all Frenchmen are in permanent requisition for the services of the armies. The young men shall fight. The married men shall forge arms and transport provisions. The women shall make tents and clothes and shall serve in the hospitals. The children shall turn old lint into linen. The old men shall betake themselves to the public squares in order to arouse the courage of the warriors and preach hatred of kings and the unity of the Republic." This radically changed the nature of war and the perception of both the state as a historical tool and the role of the citizen within the state. Prussian General Karl von Clausewitz, the most famous military historian of all time, said that this decree accessed the passions of the people, and in doing so showed the world that a united citizenry could stand up in the face of overwhelming military odds. "People at first expected to have to deal only with a seriously weakened French army," Clausewitz wrote. "But in 1793, a force appeared that beggared all imagination. Suddenly, war again became the business of the people. The full weight of the nation was thrown into the balance. War, untrammeled by any conventional restraints, had broken loose in all its elemental fury." The French Revolution, then, led not only to the rise of the nation-state and nationalism more broadly, it also opened the door to total war, the end of the distinction between civilian and military, and the willingness to weaponize an entire population toward the ends of governments. Despite the internal collapse of the French Revolution, the power of the French military never wavered. Napoleon's coup merely made clear what had already become obvious. Military nationalism was the wave of the future, and other states would have to struggle to respond in kind. The nation-state was the tool of progress and of history, and other states would not be long in reacting to the rise of France with similar enthusiasm for nationalism, and more dangerously, enthusiasm for ethnically based expansionist nationalism. Now, nationalism on its own can be a powerful force for good. Philosopher Yoram Hazony defends nation-states built on two principles. First, what he terms the moral minimum required for legitimate government, which would include minimum requirements for a life of personal freedom and dignity for all. Second, the right of national self-determination, rights accruing to nations cohesive and strong enough to secure their political independence. A multiplicity of nation-states can be a guarantee against universal tyranny, and a guarantor of philosophical, legal, and political diversity. It was respect for such diversity that brought about the Peace of Westphalia. American exceptionalism fulfills Hazony's criteria. The Declaration of Independence and Constitution operate as creedal unifiers, and a shared history and culture operate as the glue holding together the nation. But nationalism can also be a force for evil. Nationalism turns toxic when it fails to reach that moral minimum, when it tyrannizes its own citizens or locks people out based on immutable characteristics. Nationalism turns poisonous when it becomes imperialism, when it suggests that it represents a universalism that can override the legitimate rights of other states, or when it uses national interest as an excuse for conquest on behalf of a Volk. Revolutionary France quickly bled over into imperialism. That was no coincidence. But the rise of revolutionary France led other nations to embrace its romantic nationalism. In Prussia, Johann Fichte, 1762 to 1814, famously suggested, "Of all modern peoples, it is you in whom the seed of human perfection most decidedly lies, and to whom the lead in its development is assigned." Perhaps the key philosopher espousing the power of nationalism in history, and one of the most influential philosophers of the century overall, was Georg Hegel, 1770 to 1831. According to Hegel, individuals were defined by the life of the state. The state may be created by individuals, but eventually it supersedes them. The state shapes men and civilizations, and those who impose its will are the civil servants, guided by reason, the class of men both made by the state and who work for it. And states, as the embodiment of the rational state of a nation, settle matters between themselves through conflict. The individual's mind is suffused into a zeitgeist, a spirit of the age. That zeitgeist carries with it the seeds of history and is brought into being by history itself. History is the great arbiter of right and wrong in Hegel's view. Hegel saw God not in morality or reason, but in the progress of history. History moved forward, using and discarding men at will, ushering in the betterment of the world through the clash between thesis and antithesis, which would be eventually brought together in synthesis. War could be a key tool in this process. Through consciousness, rational spirit intervenes in the order of the world, Hegel wrote. This is spirit's infinite tool, also bayonets, cannons, and bodies. The 19th century's embrace of the new concept of romantic nationalism offered a purpose without Judeo-Christian values or Greek telos, the nation, spurring forward the progress of history, unified by ethnicity and background, proselytizing with its power. Nationalism also unified the question of individual and collective capacity by suggesting that they were one and the same. Your individual identity lay in your identity as a member of the collective, and the collective existed to give you spirit and strength and purpose. It's an obvious truism that nations find collective identity in language and culture. But the question is whether that culture forwards fundamental God-given rights, or whether that culture becomes an excuse to take away rights in the name of collective self-preservation. Romantic nationalism is not patriotism, but the appeal of romantic imperialistic nationalism has never died. And that fiery appeal, unmoored from any transcendent values, has burned millions in its heat. The Utopia of Leveling. The French Revolution's murder of the Judeo-Christian God meant substituting a supposedly more realistic materialism for transcendental values. The Bible contended that man could not live by bread alone. The French Revolution contended that without bread, nothing else mattered. Thomas Paine, author of the most important political pamphlet in modern history, Common Sense, saw the French Revolution as a powerful, necessary move in favor of social leveling. An ardent atheist, Paine rejected the value of Judeo-Christian morality and instead promoted redistributionist materialism. In particular, Paine targeted the class distinctions that so characterized Europe. The aristocracy, he wrote, are not the farmers who work the land, but are the mere consumers of the rent. And those aristocrats were living off the backs of a great portion of mankind who suffer in a state of poverty and wretchedness. Paine wrote, "One extreme produces the other. To make one rich, many must be made poor. Neither can the system be supported by other means." Paine would also argue that the working hand perishes in old age and the employer abounds in affluence. No wonder revolutionary France made Paine an honorary citizen. Paine quickly became a devotee of proto-socialist Gracchus Babeuf. Property, Babeuf's followers argued, is therefore the greatest scourge on society. It is a veritable public crime. Paine quickly began to believe the same and advocated for a system of ground rent for property ownership, the proceeds from which would be distributed among the citizenry. Paine argued that private property was a mere convention, and that all private property was actually the work of society at large. Personal property is the effect of society, and it is as impossible for an individual to acquire personal property without the aid of society as it is for him to make land originally. Thus, the state is master over all private property, and a revolution would be necessary to effectuate that reality. The French Revolution didn't end in a communist utopia, but according to Karl Marx, it was the first step in the gradual evolution of markets toward communism. In The 18th Brumaire of Louis Napoleon, a pamphlet written in 1852 regarding the French coup of 1851, Marx wrote that the French Revolution had set for itself the task of unchaining and setting up modern bourgeois society, but that its own commitment to classical republican ideals had prevented the class uprising that could liberate its citizens from the shackles of class. That revolution, Marx thought, had nearly been achieved in the communist movements that spread across the continent of Europe like wildfire. And soon, that communist utopia would be achieved. As Marx and Frederick Engels wrote in the Communist Manifesto in 1848, a specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism. So, what was this specter? Today, Marx's more aphoristic credos have become legendary. From each according to his ability, to each according to his need, and workers of the world unite, and the like. But his philosophy represented a radical new attempt to find meaning in a world without God. Like Paine before him, Marx saw free markets as a system of exploitation. According to Marx, the value of a product could be measured by its socially necessary labor time, the average number of work hours needed to create a product. Manufacturers could only gain profit by artificially driving down the socially necessary labor time or by forcing laborers to work longer hours. The capitalist can only become rich by exploiting workers. Workers never see the fruits of their labor thanks to capitalists taking the excess labor off the top for themselves. This system, Marx believed, demeaned human beings. Human beings are built to produce in accordance with the law of beauty, not merely for survival. Labor makes men free, Marx stated. But in tearing away the object of his production from man, estranged labor therefore tears him away from his species life, his true species objectivity. His inorganic body, nature, is taken from him. What sort of human beings would be produced by a truer system of labor? The man freed to be an individual by the collective. Marx posited that only in community does an individual have the means of cultivating his gifts in all directions. Only in the community, therefore, is personal freedom possible. In a real community, the individuals obtain their freedom in and through their association. Eventually, human nature would be restored by the collapse of capitalism, and this collapse would, in turn, drive the creation of a new man, a better human being. Marx's promise was a transcendental promise, not merely a material one. Like Rousseau, Marx believed in the power of the collective. And, like Rousseau, Marx saw a return to human nature as a good to be bought at the cost of civilization. Communion with the collective, in Marx's view, can only be brought about by changing history. Like Hegel, Marx attempted to uncover the plot of history, which he thought inevitably led to a brighter future. But unlike Hegel, Marx believed that human beings had to take an active part in their history-making in order to change themselves. Human beings, Marx posited, were animals, and thus part of their environment. But they could also change the environment in which they lived, and by doing so, change themselves. All that would be required was the will to overthrow old systems. Mankind could be perfected through a program of rigorous and continuous revolution. Abolishing private property would end alienation. Abolishing the family would end the exploitation of children by parents and wives by husbands. Does it require deep intuition to comprehend that man's ideas, views, and conceptions, in one word, man's consciousness, changes with every change in the conditions of his material existence, in his social relations, and in his life? Marx and Engels wrote in the Communist Manifesto. Yes, of course the old morality would be abolished. But more important, it would be made utterly obsolete by the creation of new human beings, since all prior morality was reliant on the exploitation of one part of society by the other. The Judeo-Christian God would have to be buried. The abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is a demand for their true happiness, Marx stated. Greek search for purpose would have to be directed at revising society itself. A new age would be born, and a new human being would rise to occupy it. Fortunately, Marx had a program that could achieve this world-changing transformation. First, the proletariat would use its political supremacy to wrest, by degree, all capital from the bourgeoisie, to centralize all instruments of production in the hands of the state. And naturally, this would entail despotic inroads on the rights of property that could appear economically untenable, but would soon work themselves out. This would involve abolition of property and land, a heavy progressive tax, confiscation of all property of immigrants and rebels, centralization of credit in the state, centralization of all means of communications and transportation by the state, extension of those means of production by the state, forced labor, equal liability of all to work, forced resettlement of populations, and free education. Then, magically, the ills of modern society would disappear. The conditions for the existence of class antagonisms will disappear, and the glory of the collective will be established for all time. In place of the old bourgeois society, with its classes and class antagonisms, we shall have an association in which the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. The individual will define himself by association with the collective, and the collective will work as a unified individual. Marx offered a transformative vision of humanity, a system of meaning and purpose. He acknowledged that suffering would follow from his recommended policies, but suggested that such suffering would, in the end, result in a messianic age of man, in which collective reason would unify with individual meaning. Marx's specter would indeed come to dominate the world, looming astride civilization like a vengeful anti-deity. His philosophy would damn millions to slavery and haunt the openness and freedom of the post-Enlightenment world with the specter of a glorious utopianism. the utopia of bureaucracy. The rise of nationalism and the rise of collectivism were both driven at their root by the Rousseauian worship of the general will. But how could such a general will ever find its way to practical implementation? Individual action outside the rule of the general